you. Wallace watched him with those darkly luminous eyes. If I told her, she'd worry, maybe even freak out. I don't need to see that, but I have to confide in someone, and you owe me.
I do?
For saving your ass, back when you were hanging out like a slab of meat.
Ah, Wallace had him there. Collie, too, for that matter.
Just listen, the soldier said to silence him. I'm not sure how long I have, you understand? I'm not sure how long it'll take before I go full-on zombie, okay? It's going to happen. Almost happened the other day back in that house, just before the grenades came through the window. If Collie hadn't have yelled at me, I know I would have dropped down on my knees and started eating. She yanked me back from doing a very bad thing, and if I started, I wouldn't have stopped. Pretty sure of that. She brought me back, and I managed to control that urge. But it'll happen again. I feel it coming. In the not-too-distant future, too, I'll cross over. When I do, and if you're there, save Collie the job of putting me down, okay? You finish me. The moment you hear a moan leave my lips and I don't respond to questions, you put a bullet in my head. I'd ask you to do it now, but...
Wallace didn't finish the sentence. Gus prodded.
But what?
Those dying eyes regarded him, and that cold smile thawed as if touched by warm flesh.
I don't want to leave her just yet.
Though Wallace might not feel any physical pain, anyone could detect the emotional hell twisting the soldier round and round inside.
I can do that, Gus said, not feeling good at all. If I can, when the time comes, I'll finish it.
That pleased Wallace, and he nodded.
She's second to none, he continued. A professional, through and through. A woman, and a wife, on top of all that. You know how we were married? At Whitecap? No church service for us. I snuck into her quarters and got into the bed beside her, and you know what she said? Will you marry me? I said, here? And she said, yeah, right here, right now. I said, don't we need an official for that, to make it legal and binding? And she said every engagement we'd ever fought in, every life we'd ever rescued on a mission, every life we'd ever taken, and we took our goddamn share and then some, was legal and binding, for better or worse. So we made our vows right there, and we didn't need anyone sanctioning it, didn't need any blessing, and sure as hell didn't need a ceremony. Then she went on about wolves and how they mate. So that was that. We married each other in her room, in the dark, on just a few simple words that to this day are as hard as tempered steel.
The story definitely threatened to ruin Gus's buzz, and Wallace wasn't finished.
Listen, he kept on. I want you to do something else for me. I don't know how this is going to end, but I'm betting it won't be the way I want it. Never is. The final transition will be a walking corpse. And if past behavior is any indication, I won't realize it's happening at all. My mind will already be gone. So, do me a favor. She'd kill me for saying this, but watch her back, okay? Take care of her, and she'll take care of you. She's that kind of person. But she's not invincible, so watch her back. Do that for me, okay? When I'm finally gone.
Gus rolled his head on his shoulders in a disbelieving fuck me kind of way, not liking the spot he was in or the promise Wallace demanded. Even just speaking of Collie and his presence made him feel uncomfortable.
All right, Gus finally said in a somber tone. Don't worry about it.
And one more thing, Wallace began.
Jesus, how many things do I owe you? Gus blurted. Just one more. Gus stared at Wallace across the table. What is it? You sure? Yeah, I'm sure, but no more after this one, that's it. So, out with it. If you can, bury me. Bury you? He asked dubiously. Yeah. That's probably the easiest one yet. I'm serious. Gus drained his drink, shivered, and reached for the bottle. Okay, done. I'll do all that and bury your ass, too. Anything else? Wallace thought about it. No, nothing. Just being buried by people is something. All the missions I ever went on, there was always a risk of not coming back home, dying out there in secret, of my family never knowing how I went down, you understand? Maybe they'd even bury an empty box with a flag on it. Nowadays, a proper burial is precious. I don't want to be left rotting in the sun. Do it right and return me to Earth, okay? A proper burial is precious. The sentiment echoed in Gus's mind, reminding him of Adam and the others back on the farm. Wallace noticed his silence. Believe me, if I could do it myself, I would. Gus had no response to that. You owe me, Wallace reminded him with ominous sincerity. And besides... His expression sagged. Besides what? Gus asked. I've got no one else to ask. That frank admission locked Gus into agreement. All right. Done. If I can, I will. Then we're good. Wallace held out his drink. One thing, Gus said before tapping mugs, to make your requests official and all. What's that? Gus took a breath and stared the dying man in the eye. Stop calling me fucking Civvy. Chapter 34. In the morning, the people of the roadside town came forth from their devastated homes. They bore suitcases and long, solemn faces. Gus watched them as he endured a lava flow of guilt of having broken his dry spell. A wicked hangover accompanied his self-reproach, the first in a very long time, and an artillery shell right between his ears. He studied the people with a pained grimace. He could tell the ones who'd cried during the night and who'd held it together. He hoped that wherever Pine Cove was, it was as good as Collie made it sound. Phil spoke for his people, and the old gentleman from this northern town politely requested that if it was all the same to them, they'd like to go along to this new place Collie had spoken of. The rest of the morning passed quickly as they loaded people and possessions into the massive rigs. Jim directed them to a shed behind the service station, containing a treasure trove of red gasoline containers. Collie stood beside Gus and Wallace as they topped off the tanks of the RVs and pickup before loading the remainder into the box. There's 14 of these people, she reported as she placed the last gas container inside the box. 5 men, 6 women, and 3 teenagers. Gus studied the people loading bags into the motorhomes. They're riding with Wallace? No. Unfortunately, there'd be too many questions and just a little bit of nervousness. Jim says he can drive the RV. You're getting kicked out of your rig, Ollie? Gus feigned shock. You don't get to call me Ollie, Wallace told him. And yeah, I'm getting kicked out of my rig, much as I hate it. No other way to transport all these people. He'll drive the pickup, Collie said. So we're heading back to Pine Cove? Gus asked. That's right, Collie said, sticking her mask into a deep pants pocket. Only an overnight detour. We'll drop these civvies off and get back to looking for your people in the morning. Sorry again, Gus. It's okay, he answered and stepped back from the truck. Maggie, Becky, and Chad were still alive out there. One sidetrack wouldn't make a difference in his search, but it would make a difference to Phil and his people.
We'll take the pickup, Wallace said, nodding at Gus to include him.
We?
We. They're a problem?
No. No, just surprised is all.
Concern was evident on Gus's face.
You're becoming best buddies, Collie smirked. The therapeutic magic of booze.
Yeah, Gus said off kilter.
What's wrong? Collie asked. Don't worry.
Wallace shook his head at the man.
We'll drive with the windows down.
Well, nothing's wrong, Gus answered brightly.
The little convoy hit the road just after 10:30. Gus nodded in and out of sleep as the moving vehicle rattled through the drabness of the countryside's colors. The residual hangover of the first buzz he'd experienced in a long time still scratched at his skull. The cavernous interior of the truck was comfortable. Not quite as roomy as the old beast, but it wasn't a rolling coffin, and for that, Gus thanked the Lord above. Cold air flowed through a cracked-open window, keeping Wallace's increasingly bad body odor from becoming too overpowering. They took the lead in the motorcade, the RVs swelling at times in the side mirrors, shrinking at others. Highways became lineless, bursting asphalt strips where the world gnawed on the edges, leaving white kernels and crumbs. Trees grew up and linked overhead, speckling the ground in early winter light. Decapitated signs made Gus wonder dreamily where the hell they were heading. Ghost towns appeared in the blazing periphery, allowing themselves to be glimpsed only for a few seconds before disappearing. Gus saw all this in timeless, dreamy intervals when he cracked open an eye. He glanced over at Wallace once, but the nightmarish soldier was simply driving on with grim determination, visor lowered, grin in place, both hands gripping the wheel. A name came to Gus's sleepy, pain-racked mind, but he didn't dare say it, for fear of bad dreams. Or bad luck. Sleep pulled him down, and Gus knew no more. Numbness rushed over the JTF-2 operator's hands and legs as Gus's snoring flipped a switch in Wallace's mind. He glanced over at his passenger sleeping, mouth slightly opened. Wallace didn't see a tattered beard or balding crown. He didn't see the scarring. All he saw, he realized with dawning horror, was a sleeping man. A defenseless man. Wallace's attention flicked between the road and his passenger. His stomach clenched, the first time ever, and a pang of hunger so alarming seized him, leaving him dizzy. His jaws ached and he opened them, stretching them to their fullest like dogs testing their leashes. The road mesmerized Wallace. Colors streaked by at light speed. His heart thumped softly at first, but then revving up in an irregular tempo like a blown tire. That puzzled him. How could his heart be beating, be racing at a time like that? A slug of a tongue grazed his lips and he realized he was salivating. The road. Stay on course. Gus snored, wrenching Wallace's attention back to the sleeping man whose face turned toward him and rattled along with the truck. A smell came from Gus, subtle yet familiar. Tantalizing. The truck coasted to the right and Wallace corrected the drift with a broken spring snap of teeth. He had a problem. The cadence of his heart suddenly braked and slowed, which sent alarm signals to his brain. The lingering smell grew stronger. Each muffled drumbeat captivated him. He hadn't realized before, but there was something haunting about that organic rhythm. It unnerved him. And he cringed every time he heard it, hoping each spaced-out beat would be the last. Wallace corrected his driving again and scowled as the RVs came closer in his side mirrors, urging him onward. It occurred to him he could pull over and let them drive on by. Long enough for... Wallace set his jaw. Long enough for what? Then fear seeped into his mind. He knew what was happening as sure as his heart throbbed with mournful purpose. He knew with ravenous clarity. He was going over. The trees flashed by, light flickering through the overhead branches, dulled by his visor. he recognized the smell haunting him. Flesh. Living flesh beside him. His heart kept on pounding, an evil, nauseating sensation in his chest, an unpleasant, tempting drum roll. It boomed in his ears, urging him to do something, promising him if he just surrendered to that mounting craving, if he just quit denying himself, the transition wouldn't be that bad. Not really. Wallace stepped on the brake, decreased speed, and pulled over, allowing the others to drive on. He lowered his eyes as if studying the dashboard in case Collie glanced his way with a question on her face. He waved a hand, and the motorhomes rolled on by. Gus kept on sleeping. Boom. His heart had become a primitive, solitary drum, and Wallace regarded his passenger's comfortable face, unconcerned, at peace, unaware. Boom. Wallace stretched his jaws to their maximum, yearning to bite, eyeing the sustenance just an arm's length away. Then he drifted, like a boat caught in a riptide, leaning toward the sleeping man on the passenger side until his seatbelt stopped him. Wallace pawed at the release button. A loud click resulted, and the seatbelt slithered away. Boom! His heart wasn't his at all. The organ called him, insisting he strike. Boom! Wallace winced, his jaws aching. A rumble started at the back of his throat, his parched throat. His hand rose, hooked into a claw and poised to plunge into the sleeping face and rake the eyeballs from its head. The heart continued its gallows gonging in Wallace's ears. Every fiber of his being pushed, commanded him to pounce, to feast. Wallace's hand trembled. His fingers curling in on themselves, creating a vengeful fist that hung in the air like an iron meteorite seized in a magnetic field. The JTF-2 man closed his mouth, resisting the tractor pull of an easy meal. Wallace leaned back defiantly as every instinct howled at him to chew into that candy shell of a skull, to crack it open and pluck that head cheese free in fluffy clumps and devour it. He straightened, shaking with the massive battle between will and hunger. Gus's heart, Wallace once more recognized the man sitting next to him, still beat its tune, determined to summon the monster lurking within the special operator. Wallace drew back from that calling, tapping into a reserve of self-discipline he still possessed. He pressed back into his seat, defying the malefic craving infecting his person. Wallace reached out and placed one hand on the steering wheel, gripping its knurled curve in a stranglehold and holding on. But Gus's heart kept calling. A ferocious, final urge to bite rose within Wallace, surging through the shield of his resolve, demanding he chomp down and let the juices flow. He whined at the strength of the assault. The planetary force that assailed him was the strongest he'd ever experienced, and anyone else would have been instantly swept away. Wallace was not, however. At least not right away. He shivered, trying to think about Collie. He tried thinking about past missions. Each memory stomped a foot down and pulled back, defying that monstrous impulse. He knuckled down and held on to the steering wheel, but the desire stayed, doubling in intensity. Wallace realized he was locked into a losing tug of war, where each passing microsecond was a foot sliding in wet sand, dragging him back toward a red line of no return. Unless. Wallace saw his own arms. He lifted his left forearm to his mouth and ripped the cloth back from his wrist, exposing graying flesh. Meat. His resistance snapped like a steel cable stretched past its limit. Wallace bit down hard. Gus woke to the sound of chewing. He opened his eyes and saw Wallace eating his own arm. In a moment of sleep-drunken wakefulness, Gus believed he was in the middle of a nightmare, until Wallace's visor turned ever so slightly in his direction, caught in the middle of one last round of mastication. Black juice covered his lower jaw, and when Wallace lowered his gnawed arm, shreds of skin and muscle tissue were revealed.
Jesus Christ, Gus said in horror.
Then his brain crackled and flashed and came totally online, and he jerked away in his seat. The seatbelt restrained him, and for an insane flicker of time, he was divided between clawing at the release button and pulling out a pistol.
Jesus Christ!
Wallace spat out whatever occupied his mouth. The gob hit the stick shift with a wet, derisive smack.
Jesus Christ! Oh, Jesus Christ!
Gus heaved against the seatbelt and nearly exploded against the windshield and roof when a finger found the release button. He groped for the truck door. It opened, and Gus tumbled from the interior as if someone had yanked the door from the outside. Crushed stone and chunks of pavement sanded his palms, but he rolled over and crawled away from the truck at best speed, keeping his eyes on the swinging door, looking for the undead cock gobbler to come leaping out after him. But Wallace didn't. Gus didn't see a ditch behind him, but his left hand found the empty space. He steamed into it, fell over, tried to roll, and slammed his chin into hard-packed earth, cross-checked by gravity. The impact dazed him. He struggled through the sensation and stood, fumbling at one holster and unintentionally whipping the weapon far away to his right. Squealing, Gus got his hands on his second pistol and successfully pulled it free. He pointed it at the truck's cab as the swinging door creaked closed.
Wallace, you there?
No answer.
Wallace, you answer, or by fuck I'll shoot you.
Again, no answer. Gus stepped to his right and stuck his neck out, widening his field of vision. Wallace sat in the driver's seat, helmeted head resting against the upper curve of the steering wheel.
Wallace!
The soldier slowly plopped back against his seat as if recovering from a head-on collision. Black stains covered his mouth.
You finished lunch in there? Gus bawled.
Wallace's head and chest heaved, chuckling. That response made Gus feel a little better. If Wallace had crossed over, the guy would be fighting to get out of the truck. Gus walked closer and pulled open the passenger door, keeping his bulk before him as a shield.
You okay?
Wallace didn't answer.
Come on, man, say something.
Shoot me.
That put a frown on Gus's sickened face.
You heard me.
With an executioner's grace, Wallace reached up and pulled his helmet off, revealing black veins webbing his temple. Black worms pulsed underneath the surface of his pallid skin. He flopped back and indicated his head.
Blow it off. Right here.
He tapped his brain pan.
Do it.
Gus took a calming breath and held it.
You're fine now.
Wallace rolled his head on his shoulders.
Now, what happened to you? Came over me all at once. I wanted to chew your face off while you slept. An urge worse than a jacked-up nicotine craving, if you ever smoked, that is.
No, Gus admitted. Never.
Doesn't matter. I can't do that again. Shoot me, and get it over with.
The command jolted Gus, leaving him hesitant to pull the trigger. He had killed in the past, in self-defense, or so he'd convinced himself, but never as an executioner. The gun wavered, heavy as lead.
Shoot me and get it over with, Wallace had said. He had pleaded. Do it,
the stricken man grunted. Opaque eyes narrowed to slits. Gus shook his head and lifted the weapon, pointing it at the soldier's head and lining up the sights.
I can. You saved my life. You'd be saving mine.
That didn't make it any easier.
Remember what you said you'd do.
Wallace made an effort to draw his lips over his teeth.
You remember. I can't.
A sad smile spread over Wallace's face. The sound of an approaching engine broke the tension. Gus and Wallace looked to see a Winnebago coming back up the road in slow, careful reverse. The white ass of the vehicle bobbed this way and that, but stayed on the deserted stretch of highway. As jarring as it was to see the RV, it wasn't near the shocker of seeing Kali crouched on the roof and focused on the pair. The scowl on her face was as mean as Gus had ever seen, and as lovely.
"Shit," Wallace muttered. "Can't catch a break."
Gus lowered the outstretched gun. When it reached the truck, the Winnebago stopped with a squeal of brakes and exhaust. Kali stood up, her hand on her sidearm.
"What's going on?"
"Going on?" Gus repeated, at a loss before that furious countenance. "What's going on is your man just tried to bite my face off, and now I'm deciding if I should honor his request to put him down." But he didn't say that. He just stood there like a deadhead with a red dot on its forehead.
"Nothing, Kali," Wallace came to the rescue. "No problem. I don't remember asking you a goddamn thing."
The ice in those words flash-froze Gus's balls and guts in one breathtaking instant, and he eyed Wallace nervously.
"Kali, shut the fuck up, Ollie," she barked. "Gus, answer my fucking question before I forget who you are and who I am."
Gus didn't want her to forget.
It's like, Gus?
Yeah.
"Before you continue, you just remember that was my husband you were pointing a weapon at."
With that, Kali drew her own.
"I told him to shoot me," Wallace said in his zen tone. "Crazy bitch."
Kali returned her sidearm to its holster and stared off at the trees for a stabilizing moment. Gus wasn't about to say shit until he was in the clear.
"Gus."
"Yeah?"
"You're good."
"Oh, thank Christ." "Thanks, Kali."
"Get aboard the RV."
Wallace and Gus exchanged looks.
"Don't look at that bastard," Kali warned. "Chances are I'll fucking murder him myself in the next few minutes. Get aboard the vehicle. And sorry for the tone of voice."
"It's okay." Gus glanced at Wallace again before doing as told. The glum look on Wallace's decomposing face said it all. He was in shit. He knew he was in shit, and Gus wondered what Kali would do with her husband. Maybe the Special Forces had training for situations like this.
"Gus, tell Jim to take you and drive on back to Phil. Then you wait. Wallace and I will be along shortly in the pickup. We'll take the lead from there. Got all that?"
"Yeah." Kali's boots pinged on the rear ladder as she descended. Gus didn't dare look back at the pickup for fear of earning more of her wrath. He climbed aboard the motorhome filled with wondering people. They regarded him, faces demanding updates, so he provided one. "Kali says we drive on back to Phil. She and Wallace have a few things to work out."
"Wallace?"
one of the middle-aged women asked. Gus had forgotten her name but noted her missing teeth.
"That the one who's sick?"
"Yeah."
"He turn yet?"
"No," Gus said, the need to defend him flaring up. "He didn't turn."
"He will,"
the woman warned, her eyes looking at the road. Chapter 35. The little convoy stopped for the night in a gas station parking lot, allowing the survivors to stretch their legs for a bit before returning to the relative safety of the motorhomes. Kali appeared and gave curt instructions for the following day, and that was the only time Gus saw her. Wallace did not show at all. The operators had maintained a safe distance from them all since the roadside incident when Wallace had almost turned. Gus understood the reason for the separation. With Wallace being a question mark, keeping him away from everyone was wise. The next morning, the RVs rolled onward. Gus took a shift at the wheel, following the lead pickup and wondering what waited at Pine Cove. Conversation was low to non-existent, and Gus didn't engage the survivors traveling with him. He knew as little as they did. Signs heralded approaching towns like spoilers for a horror movie. If the folks riding with Gus had been quiet before, they were subdued by the sights of gutted homes and buildings, crashed vehicles, and the occasional sprinkling of yellowed bones on the wayside. Terrible battles had scraped these smaller towns off the map, leaving only piles of charred debris and wrecked property, evoking memories of Annapolis's fire-washed streets. Gus hoped Maggie and the kids were alive. The sky reddened into evening as the little convoy drove along Highway 17, eventually linking up with the 132, steadily bearing down on the coastal bastion known as Pine Cove. Collie drove along a battered strip of road that might have received extensive shelling at one time. Potholes and pits blotted the pavement while vehicles littered the shoulders. Some cars lay on their roofs, crunched to a third of their size. Others seemed to have been blown apart in spectacular fashion. Gus drove through the mess, spotting a naked and twisted chassis halfway up a tree that might have been napalmed at one time. The forest around that morbid badge had been ravaged by an unchecked blaze, leaving only blackened frames and a thick dew of ash. The entire strip might have been firebombed at one point, intentionally or perhaps accidentally. The chassis suggested someone had a twitchy missile finger. The rescued folks hunkered down in the RVs, studying the morbid landscape with narrow-eyed sadness. All the while, the sun blazed a frigid red. They all wondered where the soldiers were leading them. Ahead, a single taillight flared to life as the pickup braked, forcing Gus to do the same. Collie got out of the cab and walked back. He opened the window and stuck his head halfway out.
Yeah.
We're almost to Pine Cove,
Collie said, all business, which made Gus go cold inside.
We'll lead you to the gate and let Spencer know you're okay.
Who's Spencer?
The gate watch, you'll see. Some real forest up ahead. Not the horror show we went through today. Then it's through a big rock cut through a hill. At the end will be a wall of piled car wrecks and a bus that serves as a gate. I'll do the talking, and after that, you're on your best behavior.
Where are you guys going to be?
Good question.
Collie shrugged, her scarred features showing emotional fatigue.
Wallace is going through a rough time right now. We're going to see it to the end, whichever end that might be. We'll return to Pine Cove when this is finished, one way or the other. Clear?
Clear, yeah.
All right. You're good then.
She turned to walk away.
Collie.
That stopped her, and she glanced over her shoulder.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, for what?
Whatever it is I've done.
You're fine, Gus. Wallace told me everything. I'm not mad at you. I'm just pissed at him. Just might seem otherwise. We're good. Just gotta get through the next couple of days. If that. Rough times on the horizon, you know?
Okay.
Gus felt shitty anyway and didn't understand why, clearly. But he figured that when the time came for Wallace to die, Collie had decided if anyone was going to send him off, it would be her.
And I just wish...
Collie started and paused.
We had a little more time together.
Yeah.
Later, Gussie.
Yeah. Later.
Collie continued back to her pickup, and Gus watched her go.
Tough lady, Phil muttered nearby. Toughest I know, Gus admitted.
20 minutes later, roller coaster hills with sharp inclines loomed over both sides of the road. A thick forest covered those undulating peaks, darkened by the oncoming night. Gus hunkered over the steering wheel, minding the highway while sneaking looks at how high those little mountains rose. The road curved to the left and stabbed through the center of one of those tall mounds, through an impressive rock cut illuminated by headlights. Layers of dark stone passed by Gus's window, making him wonder how much explosive was used to split that particular hill and how many working hours it had taken to clear it. The end result, however, was a nearly perfect natural defense for Pine Cove. The undead would struggle with climbing those peaks.
Been up here once, Phil disclosed.
The older man had taken the passenger seat and was staring out at the towering landscape, his posture and profile reminiscent of a weathered sea captain.
Pine Cove's a small fishing town, kept going by a seasonal crab processing plant. Mostly old folks like myself lived there. Young ones all went off to the cities or whatever. Nice place on the water. Or so I remember it that way.
They sure as hell blew the shit out of this hill, Gus remarked. If I didn't know better, I'd say we were in an open pit mine.
The taillights of Collie's pickup flashed red as it slowed and pulled over. Ahead of the truck, a wall of cars piled four deep blocked the road. A walkway bridged the roofs of the cars, shielded with slabs of scrap metal on either side of a main gate barring any further progress. The gate itself, higher than the cars, consisted of a quilt of sheet metal. The dull pattern reminded Gus of a poorly conceived chessboard with uneven squares. Collie got out of her truck and about-faced, holding up her arms. Gus lowered himself over the steering wheel once again and tried seeing the tops of the rock cut, wondering who she was trying to hail. He couldn't see anything but sheer cliff walls.
"Can't see shit," he said. "Walls are too close and high." "It's a bottleneck," Phil said.
Gus cocked a curious eyebrow and regarded the older man.
"We're bringing home some goodies and good people," Collie shouted. "All aboard the motorhomes. Wallace and I are heading out again, so be nice to the new folks."
With that, she lowered her arms, saluted at Gus, and climbed back aboard her vehicle. The road was just wide enough to perform a three-point turn, and as she drove by, she held up her hand once more. Wallace was a gloomy cadaver on the passenger side. Then they were gone, vanishing around the bulk of the second motorhome.
"Hey," Phil grunted, pulling Gus back from his side mirror.
Figures pulled themselves into view from atop the wall, revealing themselves from the chest up. Some carried rifles and others had shotguns. Gus counted eight faces and felt his stomach nodding.
"Hey, you,"
a man shouted from the wall to the right of the gate.
"Behind the wheel."
Phil gave Gus a "that's you" nod. Gus rolled his eyes and lowered his window. He stuck his head out and yelled,
"Yeah." "Where'd Collie go?"
Gus hesitated. "Personal shit that couldn't wait."
"Personal shit?"
"Yeah, personal shit."
"Well, what was it?"
This perplexed Gus.
"Personal shit, man. That's why it's personal. I can't tell you any more than that."
A few of the men and women on top of the wall exchanged worried glances. Gus figured this group was a tight one, and no doubt knew about Wallace.
"Hold on, then," the man called back in a disappointed voice.
He turned and waved, and a few seconds later the sheet metal center of the wall moved to one side. Gus had seen the same deal in the Road Warrior, but there wasn't room behind that barrier for a bus. The people pushing the section came into view.
"Ah, mystery revealed."
Gus started up the RV.
"That's a tight fit," Phil observed.
"Looks like one," Gus agreed, and put pressure on the accelerator.
He drove through the open slot, guiding the rig through as carefully as possible. The side mirror barely cleared the edge of the cars, but the rest slipped through the opening without problem.
"Not bad," Phil smiled.
"Not this time, anyway," Gus agreed, relieved he'd gotten the bulky vehicle through.
A woman protected by a winter coat stood in the middle of the road, bathed in headlights. She beckoned him forward. The motorhome stopped before her, and she stepped around to the side door and knocked. They allowed her in, and Gus saw she was around his age, attractive, with rusty red hair. She studied them all with a critical eye before smiling.
"Welcome to Pine Cove," she said with a mild French accent.
Things happened quickly after that. Under a full moon, a pair of locals guided the motorized behemoths past a thinning wilderness, where the road eventually opened into an easy slope lined with lanes and houses, all the way down to a shoreline and a seaside bay glittering with ripples. A deserted playground went by, as did a closed Mary Muffin shop.
A service station along the road was actually servicing a car inside an open bay. A smattering of houses followed, their windows heavily boarded but with the top foot or so left open. Next were some shops with the fronts barricaded. A small square dominated the center of town with a statue of a sea-green fisherman pulling in full nets. What surprised Gus most of all, however, were the people. The townsfolk of Pine Cove slowed in their tracks and stared at the new arrivals. Some opened the front doors of their shops and stepped outside, marveling at the rigs. Children stopped with their parents or guardians and pointed. Gus figured at least 100 watched the pair of motorhomes roll by, as if they were grand floats in an early Christmas parade. The attention made him smile. The faces of Becky, Chad, and Maggie appeared in his mind, pleading, and Gus's mood darkened.
"There's so many," Phil commented.
Gus felt someone breathe on his bare head, so he glanced back to see four other survivors hunched around the red-headed Pine Cove woman sizing up the new town. The lady who'd exhaled on him didn't register his fidgeting. He eventually parked the RV in the lot of a small motel, not 50 meters away from a volunteer fire department.
"This is it," the redhead announced brightly. "Step on out and stretch your legs. Mine's a cold. We have, rooms for you all tonight. Who is the leader here?"
"He is," Phil rumbled immediately.
"I'm not the leader," Gus blurted. "I'm just the driver."
"You can talk for the rest of us," Phil said. We all trust you."
Trust. A rare commodity, precious but misplaced. Collie had freed those people while Gus had only shown up after the fight and out of breath. But Phil shut down those awkward thoughts by standing and shooing the others out the side door. An evening breeze laced with the unmistakable hint of salt water caught Gus's attention. That hooked him out of the driver's seat, and he paused only to get a crick out of his back and neck, eyeing the doorway.
"We'll get everyone situated for tonight," the redhead said, studying his face close up for the first time and faltering only for a second.
"Sounds good," Gus answered, letting the startled balk go. "And then?"
"We will see."
She smiled, showing uneven teeth and radiating kindness. Gus smiled back, tight-lipped. He looked at the scabbard with his retrieved bat just behind the driver's seat, even his pistols, but hesitated in picking any of his weapons up.
"Ah," he chuckled. "Old habits."
"Take them along if you like," the redhead offered.
That placed Gus's mind at ease. He still had the knife in his boot.
"It's okay. I'll take the chance."
"My name is Murray,"
she said, holding out a hand. "Gus," he said, taking it.
"More mouths to feed."
Will Duffer scowled from his kitchen window while a burning candle shone through the lower left corner of the glass.
"Ah, Christ," Jan Pierce lamented, shaking his head.
He met the sullen gaze of Sally Fox sitting on the other side of the table. Her hand froze in turning the base of the whiskey bottle holding the one candle providing light.
"The fuck are they doing letting them in here?" Sally said in a voice usually sweetened in public. "Winter's here, for God's sake."
"Pisses me off,"
Will muttered and put his back to the window. He regarded his companions sitting at the bare table. They weren't really friends, but rather locals who shared a harsh opinion about Pine Cove and the world beyond its sheltered borders. A cruel but face-slapping fact. The town could support only so many people, and every new body lessened the portions of everyone else who had slaved and worked and blistered their hands and feet working the fields or had fished the bay in the summer heat. It wasn't fair. Or sustainable.
"I'm going to take Minglewood aside tomorrow and have that second talk," Jan said. "In private." "That chicken shit won't say anything to Collie and Wallace."
Sally's words ended with the barest quiver. Some folks thought it endearingly cute, but at night, when she partook in conversations concerning a change in leadership, the little shiver sounded evil.
"They're the real mayors of this place,"
she finished with a pissed-off shake of her head.
"And barely around," Will muttered. "I don't think I've even seen that fucking goofball Wallace."
"Secretive, hardcore military types," Jan said and nodded warily.
"You believe that?" Will asked in disbelief.
"I sure as hell don't. I mean, seriously. Anyone could go to an army base now and dress up in combat fatigues and pass themselves off as soldiers. Any fucking one. Even a cop, for that matter.
Wallace. Bugs me. I got a feeling I'd kick Wallace's ass if it came down to it. That collie bitch, too, if she wanted to roll. Turns my stomach they run things here while running around out there."
"Maybe we should step up the day of the vote."
Will shook his head. The three of them had been making quiet rounds, feeling townspeople out on how they felt about how things were being run in Pine Cove, about people coming in, and about changing the rules.
"Every day we wait," Jan warned, "is another day them two sheriffs bring in more strays. We'll be taking on roommates before too long."
Will glanced toward the window again, thinking about how many people might have ridden in on the motorhomes.
"Motorhomes today, fucking buses tomorrow."
Jan had a point.
"And more people who might turn the vote," Sally finished.
"Yeah," Will said quietly, rubbing his stubbly chin.
They figured 25% of the townsfolk supported the idea of a new election. Will intended to nominate himself, and once in power he meant to change the town's policy on collecting strays, and that was only the start. Even if he didn't win, that couldn't be allowed to continue. He'd fight Minglewood tooth and nail on that issue. There was only so much to go around, and whoever was beyond those walls was on their own. When the motorhomes drove through the gate, Sick dropped his binoculars and stared, his green eyes narrowing into thoughtful slits behind the black ski mask. He lay on his belly, 5 feet back from the edge of the rock cut, and a 30-foot drop, hidden under the low boughs of a fir tree. He didn't fear being detected, not with his ghillie suit rendering him indistinguishable from the landscape and practically invisible in the faltering daylight. Pine Cove, for all of its precautions and defenses, did not have the most observant people guarding its borders, which was just the way Shovel liked it. Sick had an excellent view of the crude car wall and the makeshift but effective gate. Calloused fingers flexed on the binoculars as thoughts formulated in his brain. The motorhomes had been a surprise. Who knew how many bodies they contained? Not that they would be a problem for Shovel and his forces. He wondered where the pickup was headed, and if it would return. The vehicle might head up one of the many side roads where his armed companions were waiting for darkness. The pickup couldn't be holding any more than 4 people. Probably fewer. Hardly a problem if they ran into the army parked out of sight. Six fingers continued drumming the binoculars, each digit resembling a meaty leg of a very hairy spider. He wasn't the only person observing the town. Shovel had deployed 5 of them in 3 shifts per day, all set up at various points along the sloping tree line beyond the rock cut. The town's natural topography and location defended well against the undead, but against a mobilized and highly motivated unit, sharp inclines and thick trees did nothing. And once you got past that, it was a sleigh ride straight into the main street. Sick blinked as if emerging from deep sleep. If the pickup bypassed Shovel's forces, it didn't matter. The town remained the main prize. The driver and passengers were scraps compared to the bounty of potential skills and trades residing by the sea. If the pickup took a right turn and ran into Shovel, the boys would make quick work of whoever drove the vehicle. The inhabitants of Pine Cove would learn something similar later that very night, in the pre-dawn hours, when a warm bed was all that mattered and dreams ruled. With all the patience and poise of a spider, Sick slowly replaced the spy glasses to his head and became motionless, channeling all his concentration into studying the guards on the car wall. After close to a week of hiding, watching, and worst of all, waiting, Sick knew Shovel would drop the hammer tonight upon the unsuspecting populace of Pine Cove. Then the harvesting would begin. Chapter 36. Marie escorted Gus to a barricaded RCMP office, led him past the heavy outer door, and knocked for the inner one to be opened. A man in a black sweater, jeans, and work boots appeared and let them into the police building. He nodded at Marie and eyed Gus with amused interest.
New stray?
Oui, new one.
The guy grunted thoughtfully, intelligent brown eyes appraising Gus for any obvious defects.
You were in the fire?
He finally asked, a dab of French accenting his words.
Yeah. I'm Ray, Minglewood. I'm the elected mayor here.
Gus, I'm just another asshole.
Ray smirked.
Well, in time you might think that way about me. Wallace and Collie brought you in?
Yeah.
Come in.
They walked Gus into a Spartan office area filled with collapsed cubicles and a few workstations. A gun rack on a wall held 5 or 6 hunting rifles at attention, with boxes of shells at the base. Ray didn't seem to carry a weapon, but he appeared in shape, perhaps in his late 30s, and ordinary-looking. The only thing Gus really focused on was his shock of brown hair. Ray had a rainforest flowering his scalp, thick enough to shelter wildlife if needed. The three sat themselves down around a desk, and Ray leaned back, crossing one leg.
Well, this is the town.
Looks like fun.
Ray shrugged.
It's the best you'll find out east. Though Newfoundland probably has a few places, but no chance of getting over there any time soon. And I expect anyone on the island isn't so keen to get off it. Same deal with PEI, since someone over there actually blew up the bridge to the island.
The two men studied each other then, like a pair of weary gunslingers attempting to feel the other out.
So, Collie and Wallace brought you in, Ray repeated.
Me and a bunch of other folks.
Long haul?
It was. Comfortable, though, in the motorhomes. Wish I'd had one before.
Same here.
You a cop? Gus asked.
Me? No. Just a crab fisherman. But for some reason they chose to put me in charge of security and the meet-and-greet of newcomers. Not that a little Q&A is ashore, you understand. If Collie and Wallace brought you here, then that says a lot.
Silence fell then, and Gus glanced at Marie sitting at the end of the desk. She stared back, pleasantly neutral.
They're going through a hard time right now, Gus added, wondering how much he could reveal to these people.
We know, Ray said. Hard way to go. We figure Collie still isn't clear. Something could always develop a little later. We're wondering if Collie will be infected just being around him. But I'm guessing nothing will happen unless... well, unless he does something. As for Wallace, I haven't seen him face to face in about 2 months now, but I've heard from others he isn't looking so good. No one knows what's going to happen there. It's one big, shitty question mark.
They'll figure it out, Gus said.
They will, don't get me wrong. We greet them with open arms, you understand. They were the ones who isolated themselves from the town. They have a cabin on the shore, about 30 meters from here. That's where they go on their downtime, when they aren't actively looking for survivors. Wallace said so himself, that it was best for all, until this episode came to its conclusion. It's just taking its goddamn time is all.
Ray sighed.
How many with you?
A little over 12, Gus answered. The RVs are filled with everything. Food, guns, ammunition. A generator, too.
Ray's features lightened, and he glanced at Marie.
That's a surprise.
You know how to set it up? Gus asked.
Not personally, but we have a few smart people around. An electrician and a mechanic. Some houses are already powered by solar, but not all. Needless to say, hot showers around here are as good as cash.
Gus wondered if that was a hint at his own rank body odor.
Well, anyway, you look tired there, Gus. It's getting late.
Marie will find you a bunk in the community hall along with all the others you brought in, and even get you something hot to eat. Hunting and fishing around here is pretty good, and we're fortunate enough that a lot of folks already grow their own vegetables. Wasn't a big leap to convert more land over to farming. We do all right, but strive to do better.
Sounds good, Gus said distantly, remembering his farm in the valley, missing the people.
Well, welcome to Pine Cove, Ray declared with a flourish of hands. That's it. We'll have another talk in the morning. See what you and the others can offer the town. This place is only as good as its people, and it's always good to bring in more. Every person is sort of like a little treasure chest. You don't know what's inside. Any doctors among you by any chance?
Sorry, Ray.
That's okay. We'll find one sooner or later.
Gus hoped they would.
After the meeting with Ray Minglewood, Marie led Gus by flashlight through the deepening night. The community hall could have been mistaken for a church missing its cross, and Gus wondered if Pine Cove still held Monday night bingo sessions there. Maybe they did. Thick-wooded, white-painted, and with its windows boarded up, the place looked like a piecemeal bunker in the flashlight's beam. A few of the nearby houses had lights on upstairs, leaving Gus feeling as if all was right with the world for once. The doors to the hall opened, and the harmonious smells of chicken soup and baked bread smacked him in the face. Phil and Jim and their people sat at three rows of long tables, enjoying their first hot meal in a long while. Three large portable water dispensers, the emergency kind, were set up nearby with stacks of plastic cups. Curtains partitioned an arrangement of cots near the back of the interior. Candles burned in holders and lamps all along the tables, lending an angelic ambience to the scene.
Whoa, Gus said, a little breathless at the sight of the meal. You guys got this on quick, didn't you?
Not really, Marie said. They're eating leftovers from this evening, and that bread's fresh baked. We have a few old-fashioned ovens in town that are kept busy.
Jesus Christ.
Gus couldn't remember the last time he'd eaten fresh bread. His stomach tugged on his tongue, looking for attention.
Eat, relax, and get to bed. Tomorrow we'll talk again and see who wants to live where.
Huh?
We have plenty of extra houses around, all with wood-burning stoves. There's electrically heated ones as well. But no one lives in any of those, obviously. But there are a couple with solar panels installed that generate good heat in the winter.
Wow, Gus repeated, caught in another memory.
So, go ahead. See you in the morning.
Marie gestured toward the table before leaving Gus. He sized up the hall once more, smelled the food, eyed the tall pots and ladles, and listened to the sounds of eating and low conversation. It reminded him of an old-fashioned family dinner. His stomach nagged him once again, and Gus walked over to the seated people, taking a spoon and a bowl from a lady who greeted him with a genuine smile. After dinner, people settled down for the night. Not bothering to undress, Gus lay back on a cot near an emergency exit, and if he arched his head back enough on his pillow, he could see the unlit sign designating the door. The bingo hall was warm and redolent with the after-smells of a late dinner. Some folks whispered beyond the curtains. Some suppressed a cough. A cot squealed almost musically from a person's weight. Another farted, a long, sonorous note of sleepy contentment, and a chorus of giggles and chuckles answered in agreement. Gus smiled at being among people again. Not that Collie and Wallace weren't people, but being part of a community calmed his nerves. He'd lived life as a loner, and he'd lived with a small group of people. He preferred the company of people by far. Shadows flickered on the dim ceiling, lit by tired candlelight. The cot wasn't as comfortable as the bed in the RV, but the hall's ambience beat the motorhome hands down, as long as there weren't any more soup farts. His smile widened. The hall's ceiling darkened. Sleep claimed the weariest of the travelers, and Gus closed his eyes. Fathoms deep, the night sank, drowning the town in sleep. Fog crept from the smoothed glass of the bay, promising good dreams. The vapor slunk up deserted streets and coiled around mushroom-shaped lamps that lined the road, creating smoky bubbles of light. Spencer blinked at the scene, perhaps a little longer than he should have.
Dark.
November nights stretched time, making 1 second feel like 30. Staying awake during those hours could be a challenge when the only sound heard might be another's whisper or the dirge of the wind. Even though Spencer slept during the day in preparation for the night watches, that wasn't enough. He disliked the graveyard shift. It screwed up his sleep and reminded him too much of a time when a scream carried for miles. The night shift was damned lonely. Spencer sniffed and dug at an ear, rooting a finger around vigorously before working on the other. As he cleaned, he leaned against the gate's upper barrier and looked out into the rock cut. Pixie lights, little solar-powered units like the ones haunting the town, lit up the road and transformed it into a runway reaching toward infinity. Spencer sniffed again and detected movement on his right. Dalton was doing those ridiculous partial squats on the walkway, forcing blood into his thighs and ass. Below and inside the gate stood Martin and Roy, each with a hunting rifle slung over his shoulder. They'd exhausted the ammunition for the assault weapons almost a year before. Regular hunting rifles did the job just as efficiently, but Spencer liked holding an AR-20 in his hands. He appreciated the military rifle's weight. It relaxed him. Spencer took the finger out of his ear, wiped it on his jeans, and went to work on a nostril. He mined at an annoying tickle when Dalton's bulked-up form wandered over from the right.
"You know something?" Spencer whispered when Dalton got close enough.
"What?"
"With that winter coat and all on, you look like a goddamn Sasquatch."
"Thanks, fuckchops."
"Not really,"
Spencer insisted, wiping his finger on his jeans again.
"That beard of yours, them big fucking saucer eyes, like you've been sniffing something illegal, and that smell. What is that? Eau de shit? But it's hard to keep that one on the shelves."
Dalton shook his head and studied the empty road of the rock cut.
"Keep it up."
"Really?"
"Oh, yeah. You're a fucking snort and a half, especially at my expense."
"Well, you shouldn't come over here then."
"What, and miss all this charming conversation?"
"You are the source of my best material."
"Yeah? Well, glad to make somebody's night. Which reminds me, if you're finished insulting me, that is."
"Yeah," Spencer sighed. "Even that gets old eventually.
We good?"
"Fuck no, dickhead." Dalton quietly scoffed, noticing the man still trying to clean his fingers on his clothes, but deeming it not worth mentioning.
"You know, I hope there's no freaks or psychos in those two boatloads that came in today."
"Collie and Wallace have been pretty much on the money so far, with that one exception, and that one took care of himself."
"There's a clinical name for that."
"For blowing out your head cheese with a 30-30?
Dalton regarded Spencer in the near darkness.
"Spence, put the finger down and listen to what I'm saying here, okay?"
With some reluctance, Spencer complied and adjusted the strap of his rifle hanging off his shoulder.
"What I was saying is, for some people, being isolated and on their own for so long and then coming back to, well, civilization, or at least integrating with people again, it's sort of like a culture shock."
"Yeah, well, just hope there's a few hot-looking bitches in that bunch," Spencer said.
Dalton again shook his head in stoic disbelief of his companion's caveman priorities.
"We'll see tomorrow. Did see a few women get out of those RVs. Well, I'll get back to patrolling here. Thank you, as always, for the conversation, ass fudge.
Dick squid?"
"Dick squid."
Dalton mouthed the word in dismay before turning and walking away.
That's right, bitch. I win, Spencer said to the others retreating back. You just walk away. You feel ready, come on back and we'll play again. Prison rules next time. Prison rules, son. Spencer snapped on an imaginary latex glove and scooped the air with a finger. A crack of underbrush from the left caught his attention, and he turned and confronted the night. The sound didn't repeat, however, and Spencer stood there, straining to hear. His peripheral vision picked up movement on his left just below the barricade of cars, and he saw the outline of Roy standing down there. No one else in Pine Cove wore a real bear fur hat.
Roy, Spencer whispered.
Yeah.
Hear that?
Yeah.
Think it was?
Dunno. Neither did Spencer. He unslung his rifle. Roy did the same.
Too dark, Roy whispered.
Yeah.
Need to put some of them solar lights on the slope, dude.
Job for tomorrow, Spencer agreed.
No other sound came forth, but the hairs on Spencer's neck buzzed, and unease filled his guts. He knew the feeling, remembering being pulled over while driving high on a Saturday evening. Spencer leaned forward, straining to hear, and looked at Roy again, who shrugged. Urgent hisses split the night, ending in grunts from the right side of the wall, distracting both men, just as a huge figure of a man wearing a snowsuit and a gleaming hockey mask strode out of the night, materializing from seemingly nowhere and taking huge steps before winding up and swinging an axe. Paralyzed, Roy didn't even have the wind to scream as the blade chopped into his left shoulder, driving him to his knees.
Jesus!
Spencer shouted in fright and lifted his rifle. A hand wrapped around his forehead and tipped his head back, an instant before a startling pinch of pain. The world went white. Sick withdrew his slick knife from the base of the guard's skull and eased the ragdoll corpse to the floor. He watched the big ex-Norseman called Nolan wrench his axe out of the chest cavity of his victim, wind up, and hack into the head with a clap that resembled fine china shattering on a floor. Nolan's powerful grunts puffed through the punched-hole smile of the funky silver helmet he wore. Although Nolan didn't eat people anymore, unlike his former associates, killing folks and ensuring their deadness remained a much-valued priority. Over Sick's shoulder, four other men emerged from sections of underbrush where they had released their crossbow bolts. Those four confirmed their kills and dragged the bodies off the road. Sick attempted to hear over the dragging of boots in the dirt, couldn't, and frowned beneath his mask. Nolan stood up, chest heaving, his work overall stained darker than dark. He waved and Sick waved back. Nolan gripped his axe